time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for June 15th, 2019. I don't know what it's doing in your neighborhood, but it's feeling more like early April than mid-June. Cold temperatures, rain, wind, it isn't making for a fun riding season yet. But that doesn't mean we don't have a great show for you tonight. In part three of our orthopedic sports injury series with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch, we're going to explore hip impingement. When you feel that pain in your hip, it might just be the beginnings of what could become a chronic issue. Dr. Hirsch tells us what to look for and when to seek treatment. Last year, we spoke with tandem couple Tracy and Peter Flukey about their work and about the 7,000-mile tandem trip they were planning at the time. Well, on June 1st, they pushed off from the West Coast, and this evening we catch up with them for the first of a series of on-the-road conversations as they make their way toward New Orleans. And then we talk with history professor Evan Friss. His new book, On Bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City, traces the bicycle, the people who rode them, and the way the city has interacted with them beginning way back in 1819. Before we talk with Dr. Hirsch, I'd like to mention one quick note about Tour de France contender Chris Froome, or should I say, might have been contender. If you haven't heard, Mr. Froome had a nasty, nasty crash going downhill at the Dauphine while training for the time trial. He was life flighted to a hospital where he was in intensive care with several broken bones. We wish him speedy recovery, although he is out of contention for this year's Tour de France. Oh, and go USA for the Women's World Cup. So let's head on down to Boca Raton for a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. Hey, Dr. Hirsch, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. We're going to talk about hip impingement.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me back. So hip impingement, otherwise known as femoral acetabular impingement, or FAI, is sort of a constellation of symptoms, usually with pain in the groin. So when someone's hip hurts, it's usually groin pain, that develops from a mismatch a lot of the femur, which is the ball, and the acetabulum, which is the socket. So people either develop or are born with a mismatch in size and can develop wear and tear of the labrum, which is the lining of the hip joint, and the cartilage, which can lead to arthritis. So cyclists are predisposed because of the deep flexion that they're in, that we're in a lot, and the repetitive movements.
So if you were to say who is more prone to this hip impingement, men or women, is there or is it equal?
It's an equal distribution, but possibly different causes. Females are more likely to have some malformations of the socket of their hip joint, which can lead them to be slightly unstable or loose. And men seem to have more overgrowth of the bone on the femur side, causing impingement from a mechanical source, but there's such a mixed population, so it's hard to say, you know, overall who's more prone. But I see it in both in my practice relatively equally.
Interesting. So, is it more likely for a cyclist to have an impingement on one side than the other, or both sides?
It doesn't seem to have a preference for if there was a dominant leg. People do have a dominant leg, but since the motion is exactly the same for both while you're cycling or playing any sport, it doesn't seem to have a predilection. Specific sports like hockey, goalies get it a lot. It tends to be in one leg versus the other. They seem to go into more deep flexion and sometimes more their more dominant leg, let's say. But in general, you really can hit both, or I have a lot of patients in both hips simultaneously.
So what are some of the options in terms of either healing it or fixing it or preventing it?
So a lot of people have the labrum, which is what people have the pain from. The labrum is just like in the shoulder, the labrum is a cartilaginous sort of disc around the socket that tears. And some people, you can treat it conservatively and it can stop hurting. Unfortunately, when a younger person tears their labrum in the hip, it's very likely to lead to arthroscopic surgery. It doesn't have a great blood supply to heal spontaneously. We do rehab a lot of the patients first, try to work around the pain, strengthen the gluteus muscles, the pelvic muscles, sometimes adjustment of the sport, for instance, the bike seat, making sure that they're not overflexed, that they're in the appropriate position, may ease the pain and make it more tolerable. Something that you can live with, a tear of the labrum in the hip, you can play a sport with if it's not hurting much. The interesting thing about it is that we know a lot of people who have arthritis later in life had hip impingement that went untreated when they were younger. So we call it hip preservation surgery when we do it, because we know a lot of these patients, when we catch them early, if we get their labrum to heal and make the bone more normal shape, we think that down the road we're actually even preventing arthritis from developing.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. He is an orthopedic sports specialist who practices out of Boca Raton, Florida. If you let it heal or strengthen everything around it and that doesn't work, what's the next thing?
So the workup is extensive. We get MRIs, we even get CAT scans to look at the bone shapes. But if things fail, often it's arthroscopic surgery. So it's minimally invasive surgery using a camera. So it's an outpatient procedure, but it takes a while. It takes a good 4 months plus to get back to most sporting activities. We get people probably back to cycling at least lightly within the first month or two, within a certain parameters, but free to do whatever you want to be over 4 months. And some research is showing people continue to improve up to 2 years out from the procedure itself.
If the arthroscopic procedure isn't the answer, what's next? You have to actually go to some sort of replacement?
Meaning?
Well, let's say somebody's hip impingement is so severe that arthroscopic surgery is not the answer. What else could it be?
So the only reason why it wouldn't be the answer is if they already show up in the office and they develop arthritis. So a lot of our patients, their symptoms from the labral tear really wasn't there until they started to develop the arthritis. So that's the trick. A lot of the patients show up and moved on from the quote-unquote non-arthritic hip with just a labral tear to now they have both. And that's the challenging population. Now, you could get a hip replacement and still cycle, but you know, most 40 to 50-year-olds don't want a hip replacement. So there is that cohort of patients that we're trying to get them by, and those are the patients I'll offer injections, whether it's stem cells, platelet-rich plasma, a lot of the biologic injections are perfect for that middle-of-the-road patient where they have development of arthritis, so arthroscopic surgery may be sort of out of the woods for them or less likely to work, but they're not a joint replacement candidate just yet. So that's where a lot of the biologic injections come into play.
Nice that we even have those now. That's really, really cool.
Yes.
What would you say the most important things are to prevent hip impingement?
Well, certain things you can't prevent, like the shape of your hip bones. That's unfortunately out of your control. Certainly, again, getting well fitted on your bicycle. I think that's important to make sure that it's fitted for you properly and you're sitting in the appropriate position. And I think that pain that persists beyond a couple of weeks, you should see a specialist because there may be something developing that may be reversible in the hip. It doesn't always have to be a labral tear. It could be something else that if you continue to cycle through, So, you know, prevention sometimes comes after the symptoms develop, yet you are able to reverse it. Complete prevention may not be possible in certain sports, but modifying activities for a while, again, or making sure fitting is appropriate, can be really helpful.
Yeah, I really love when you say get good fits. It's my favorite.
Like,
yeah, I do. It's my favorite. Well, because it makes perfect sense. Well, this has been interesting, of course, as usual. And we will have one more part that we need to pick up a body part this coming time. We've done clavicles. If you haven't heard Dr. Hirsch and I speak about the different orthopedic problems and solutions, you can go back and research on the OutspokenCyclist.com blog. But we've talked about clavicles. We've talked about knees. Now we've talked about hips. What are we missing?
What are we missing? So we've talked about knees, hips, clavicles. I mean, other things are like ankle injuries or some of the fractures that occur. That, you know, from the unfortunate falls that people have. You know, luckily, most of the injuries are repetitive or overuse, but unfortunately, also what we see is a lot from falls off the bike.
Right. Well, maybe that's what we'll do is we'll talk about a few of the falls that can happen. Clearly, people, you know, take headers on their bikes quite a bit, unfortunately. Well, Dr. Hirsch, thank you so much again for talking with me. We will check in with you one more time over the summer. And I hope your training's going well. I know you're going on a big ride this fall. And thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. Dr. Jonathan Hirsch is an orthopedic sports specialist who practices in Boca Raton, Florida. If you haven't heard them and are interested, you can find our previous two conversations at OutspokenCyclist.com. Part 4 will be coming up next month. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll catch up with tandem couple Peter and Tracy Flukey. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back, and at day 11 in their 7,000-mile journey, I caught up with Peter and Tracy Flukey about 500 miles into their trip, somewhere near Bend, Oregon. Hey, Peter and Tracy, welcome back to the show. Where are you guys?
Well, we are on our way to Odell, Oregon. Probably the biggest nearest city would be Hood River. So we're in the Columbia River Gorge, basically.
It's pretty, though.
Oh, my gosh. We came around a corner just a little bit ago and finally got this amazing clear view of Mount Hood over the apple orchards out in kind of a rural area off the highway. Gorgeous.
Nice, nice. So let's remind our listeners what you're doing. You are taking a 7,000-mile tandem trip. When did you actually dip that rear wheel in the Pacific?
We left on June 1st and dipped our wheel in Bellingham Bay and have been on the road since.
And how has it been so far? So it's been, let's see, June 1st, today's the 11th, so it's been 11 days. And how far have you come so far?
We've traveled about 500 miles.
Nice.
We had one day off. We took like a couple days off ago, we had a day off. And it's going pretty good. I mean, it's been... For a while, it was very rainy and cold, and today it's in the 90s and hot, and tomorrow is supposed to be in the 90s and hot, so you just never know what you're going to get weather-wise.
Wow, you could be in Cleveland. Except that yesterday, you guys probably don't know this, we had an earthquake here.
Actually, I saw you posted that, and
oh,
what
yeah.
was it, a 4.4 or something like,
it actually,
like that?
It was actually 4.0, but it, I mean, I felt it. It shook. It, what was interesting is my dogs didn't react too much, and usually they react to everything. But, yeah, we felt it. It was pretty interesting because clearly we do not live in earthquake-prone California or West Coast, but occasionally I guess it happens here. So go ahead.
I was going to say the only shaking we've had so far is we just rode a stretch of I-84, had a beautiful shoulder, but there was a lot of rumbling with the trucks going by.
Oh, yeah. How much is your bike loaded down? Do you have everything with you? Are you taking tents and all that stuff?
Yeah, we're fully loaded, so we've got our tent, our camping gear. We're actually camping for the next three nights up in the Mount Hood Wilderness. So we're a little bit heavy right now. I think we're probably at 60 pounds maybe total for the gear.
That's not horrible. Are you taking your own cooking stuff too?
Yep, we have all our cooking stuff and food and our sleeping bags. So, yep, we're totally self-supported and can stop and camp at any point.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking with Tracy and Peter Flukey. They are on a 7,000-mile tandem trip. We're catching them on day 11 of the tour. We're going to be talking with them periodically throughout the summer as they begin making their way towards. And where are you headed?
Today we are headed to our final ending point. Today will be Parkdale, Oregon. But ultimately we're headed to New Orleans, Louisiana.
Are you planning to stay there for a while?
Well, I think everybody who finishes a 7,000-mile bike trip should spend at least a week minimum in New Orleans.
Would that be eating and drinking?
It's called eating, drinking, and sleeping whenever you want, and the city perfectly accommodates that.
That's true. It's a great city for all of that. Plus, you get some great music, too, right?
Yeah, we did. We rode the Mississippi River in 2015, and we finished in New Orleans, and it also allows us to take Amtrak home, which is a really nice way for us to kind of unwind and about the most cost-effective way for us to transport the tandem as well.
So how has Amtrak made taking the tandem work? Is it an S&S couple tandem, as I remember? Yes, I think it is, right?
It is an S&S couple tandem, but we don't travel with the box. So typically what we've done with Amtrak, and it's, four or five years ago, it was kind of a nod, wink, wink thing. You just waited for the right baggage handler. But we could buy two bike boxes for $15 a piece. We'd pull the pedals, turn the handlebars, and just roll the bike in there. And then I think there was a $10 handling fee. So for, $40, we could ship our bike all the way home with us as baggage.
Wow. That's way reasonable. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So from Mount Hood, from where you are now, what's your next destination? Give us a little bit of your itinerary over the next two or three weeks till we catch up with you again.
We're heading to Bend, Oregon. That'll be the next big city that we'll head to, and we'll probably get there on Saturday, I think. And then from there, we'll continue heading south towards the Sacramento, California area. We'll actually be east of the Sacramento, but in that general area. And then we'll start heading east across Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, and keep continuing to the east.
So what is your timeline in terms of getting to New Orleans?
So we don't have one exactly.
Okay.
We've kind of got this set up, so we're sort of free range right now. But we're anticipating the end of October, early November, to be down in New Orleans, resting up, and then heading back up to Green Bay.
Nice. So in the last 11 days, give us a couple of your highlights, besides the apple crates that you're leaning up against.
So yesterday, actually, we were taking, the Columbia River Gorge Highway, which is also Highway 30 up the Oregon side of the gorge. And it was just amazing. And the road was cool. But what was really cool is as they've upgraded and slightly realigned the road, they used the old road grade and the old bridges to make a recreational trail. And so we were on that part of the time. Ultimately, I believe that trail is going to go all the way from Portland over to the Dales. So it's about a third completed right now.
Nice.
Just spectacular. On a tandem.
Oh, it was wide enough and smooth enough and comfortable enough to ride the tandem. That's cool. That's very
cool. Yeah, it was probably 14 feet of brand new asphalt. So as long as you didn't overcook a corner on the pine needles, it was all good.
Yeah, right. I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Yes, yes. The only time we ever laid the tandem down was on the Erie Canal when we hit a bunch of sand at like 1 mile an hour. It was really spectacular. So, oh, did I see that you guys were in a traffic jam?
Yeah, on Highway 30 yesterday, there are a number of just incredible waterfalls that flow into the gorge, and we came around a corner and there were a bunch of cars stopped in front of us. So we figured somebody broke down or something, and what it was is about a quarter mile traffic jam where we had to get off the bike and literally just walk it in bumper to bumper traffic while cars would wait for somebody to pull out of the parking lot. We eventually figured out what was going on and were able to ride in the oncoming lane and for about a quarter mile and get around all the mess. The downside was the delay. The upside was that once we got past the roadblock, there were no cars on the road for the next, I don't know, half an hour.
What was the roadblock? I mean, what was actually, there was nothing, right? It was like a big nothing?
Basically, what was going on, there was a small parking lot there by this amazing falls, and everyone was stopping to see it, and there wasn't enough space for all the cars, so instead of people continuing past and maybe coming back later or whatever, they would literally stop in the road and wait until someone got out of the parking lot so they could turn left and go into the parking lot. So, and they were just sitting there. It was just funny. One car came out. A person that we had met at Vista House, which was a beautiful house that overlooked the gorge, we had met him there, and he came past us, and he said, it's just people waiting to get in the parking lot. He goes, you could probably sneak by on the left and continue on, and then you won't have any traffic. So that's what we did. We just kind of went past a few cars and then continued on our way.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious.
It was. And the thing we were laughing about, it was a Monday. It wasn't even prime summer season. We're like, what is this like during the summer when everybody's out, you know, trying to explore?
It yeah, just really.
A nightmare, you know, a 2-3 mile backup.
My comment to Tracy was that if all those people were in bikes, that wouldn't have been a problem.
That is so true, because the parking lot could accommodate way more bikes than cars, number one.
Absolutely.
Right. That is so true. So anybody kind of signed on to hook up with you on this trip yet?
Well, nobody's riding with us, but we've had a whole bunch of incredible interactions with folks. One of my mentors and one of the gurus in the bicycle and pedestrian world, Dan Burden, lives in
Fort Townsend.
And so we got to stay with Dan and his wife Liz on a warm shower stay and get caught up. We just spent some time night before last, in Portland, catching up with Rob Sadowski, who used to be the executive director of the Chicagoland Bike Federation, and Kyle Fordham, who is a 20-something-year-old that we met up with and rode with for about a week in 2014 in Montana when we were doing the Northern Tier. That's the ride our book is based on, and Kyle is featured prominently in there. So it was just amazing. He's getting married soon. So, I mean, that was a fairly brief encounter, but we'll be friends forever. And to be in his backyard and not see him just wasn't going to be a thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, and that is the cool thing about being on the road. You meet people and they do become like family. They just become like family. Well,
Yeah, absolutely. So
we will catch up again in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, for people who are interested, you can follow Tracy and Peter on Facebook. Give them the and the blog. So give them the information of how they can follow your trip.
Sure. So the easiest way to get all of our contact information is go to our website, which is www.webike.org. You can access our blog through there. You can also follow us on Facebook at Peter Flukey or WeBike ETC.
Okay. Well, you guys stay safe on the road. It's wonderful to talk with you again. I can't believe this trip is happening. Last time we talked, it was still in the planning stages, and now it's really, you're on your way. That's so cool. That's so cool.
Well, thank you for the support. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Stay safe out there and have fun.
Thank you.
Always take care.
We'll talk to you again.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you are interested, you can follow Peter and Tracy's journey and read their posts, as well as see some of their great photos at webike.org. We will catch up with them again in mid-July. So let's take another short break, and when we come back, it's down to Virginia to speak with Dr. Evan Friss, professor of American history, about his new book, On Bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. This is The Outspoken Cyclist, and I'm your host, Diane Jenks. When we look at the history of the bicycle, we can see how it has been a vehicle for change on so many fronts, from recreation and competition to transportation and the emancipation of women. All that and more is reflected in New York City, how the bicycle has been embraced and rejected, how government and citizens have reacted to the uses of the bicycle, and how New York seems to set the tone for how bicycles have been viewed nationwide from the early 1800s through today. Evan Friss has done a deep dive into its history in New York City with his book, On Bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City. Hello, Evan. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You wrote a new book, and I really enjoyed reading it. It's called On Bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City. It was recently published by, University Press, I think. Is that correct? Yeah?
Yes, Columbia University.
Right. Which, of course, is in New York. And it's really fascinating because it goes all the way back to the early 1800s and brings it right up to pretty much current day. So my first question to you is, how did you become so interested in the bicycle from a historical perspective?
I was living in New York City, earning a PhD in American history, and I was really interested in urban design and urban planning and questions of mobility more generally, and thinking about just all the ways that New Yorkers moved kind of through this urban puzzle and jungle. And of course, many of the decisions that we make about how we moved are shaped by historical actors, and people are likely to choose ways of mobility that are convenient and easy. And of course, we live in a country that's long been car dominated. So I was just really interested in thinking about urban transportation, in particular, the choices that we have available in today's cities and how those were shaped by previous decisions and previous actors. And while I was thinking about these kind of bigger questions, I was riding a bike to graduate school and to a friend's apartment and using the bike as a way to get around New York. So those two kind of that kind of theoretical intellectual interest merged with my practical way of moving out the city into this larger study.
Which is interesting because you just answered my next question, which was, were you riding a bike at the time? So yeah, I get it. And New York is a particularly interesting city when it comes to riding, when you think about the density of population there. So do you think that New York's history with the bicycle is different from that of other major cities over the past couple hundred years?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. So the broad trajectories about when bicycles come in and out of favor are largely American swings, both when bicycles become popular and then when they lose fashionability among tastemakers. That happens largely across American cities. But in some ways, New York's experience is distinct, and some of it is related to what you mentioned before is its density. You know, it's the largest city in the country. It's extremely dense. People commute very short distances, but it takes them terribly long times. So there are kind of, in many ways, the bicycle benefits or what it offers is greater in New York than many other places, or its potential. And some of that potential has been realized more so in New York than in some other places. And in some ways, it hasn't. So, yeah, I think it's a kind of yes and no answer, where we see moments, and perhaps we'll talk about some, where the bicycle really does seem like this perfect solution to a particularly challenging problem that New York faces, even if other cities face it. New York streets are more clogged. Its density is greater. Its traffic is worse. So in some ways, it's a kind of interesting laboratory to think about how bicycles fit into urban America.
Really? You know, I've been following some of the things New York's been doing ever since you had your transportation czar, Jeanette Sadiq-Khan. And so we got really involved in watching New York and what it was doing. And it's sort of like this window into how cities can manage cycling in some ways. And it seems like there's been sort of an acceleration of people looking at how the bicycle can fit into urban lifestyles right now. So one of the things that seems to happen in this sort of cyclical way, maybe it's cyclical, maybe it's not, I'm not sure, but it seems to, is how government reacts to having bicycles in the city. And when the bicycle first became popular in New York, it immediately came under some sort of banning of the bicycle. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, so government's role in either promoting or delegitimizing bicycles is a central part of the story, more than any single person or cyclist, champion or anti-cyclist. You know, politics and government has largely shaped where bicycles can be in New York and whether or not cycling will flourish. And so from the very beginning, when bicycles arrived in New York, which was in 1819, and these were predecessors to the modern bicycles. In fact, they didn't have pedals, but they had two wheels and were sort of like modern bikes that we might give to tots or toddlers learning, where they balance and push off the ground in order to propel them forward. And although there were very few of these bicycles in 1819, the New York City government banned them from most of the places in which they were being ridden. And this is the first bike ban, possibly in the United States, certainly the first of many bike bans to come in a variety of shapes in New York City.
What was the reasoning for banning this sort of Strider-type bike?
Well, at the time, the minutes don't actually suggest any rationale, so it's really up to us to speculate. But based on what I can gather and based on the rationale for the ban later on, it seems as if there was a concern about these toys being menaces, about them, the riders being reckless and out of control, and about people just not wanting to share space with this new alien kind of contraption.
Yeah, it sounds like what goes around comes around. The more they change, the more they stay the same. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Evan Frist. He has written a new book on bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City. Evan is a professor of history at James Madison University, which is in Virginia, not New York. However, he was in New York. So I wanted to know the kinds of changes that did happen or were put in place to allow bicycles and then to not allow bicycles, if you know. So what kinds of things did the city do besides just say, get them off the street? When were they finally allowed back on the street so that they became much more popular?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different, you know, pieces to it. One is infrastructure and the other is legislation. And so in terms of the law, it seems as if this first bike ban in 1819 was simply forgotten, and bicycles disappear on their own for about 50 years. And then in the late 1860s, now known as velocipedes, bicycles become quite popular again, and they're being ridden in Manhattan and Brooklyn and elsewhere. And there's questions about whether or not to ban them. So they're now allowed because of some municipal amnesia, I suppose. But the same debates crop up again, and there are certain restrictions. There begins a battle over whether or not these bicycles can be ridden in the parks, which are these leisure grounds, especially for the upper class, who see them as a kind of respite for the urban chaos and these nice pastoral settings that they don't want to be ruined with clumsy cyclists. So there's this big battle about whether or not bicycles can be in the parks. And the stakes were quite high because many of the streets were unpaved or paved with cobblestone. So this was really where the vast majority of outdoor cycling was taking place, was in these parks on paths that had been either meant for carriages or bridle paths, that kind of thing. And so eventually, in Central Park anyway, they are bicycles are ultimately banned. And from the late 70s and early 1880s, there's this great battle for Central Park in which cyclists eventually win selective access to the park. That is, members of elite bicycle clubs could access the park for certain periods of the day. And this was seen as a great kind of win. And over time, cyclists' access to the parks would increase, but their place on the road would shift depending again on the larger politics of the day. So whether or not they were allowed on the streets and how they were allowed to be on the streets in the 1890s, when bicycles were very popular, New York passes a state law, in fact, that defines the bicycle as a vehicle, grants it essentially the same rights as any other moving vehicle on the street. And this law, some version of it still remains today and has been a kind of pesky thorn for some people who've tried to knock bicycles off the street. But throughout much of the 20th century, it kind of zigs and zags and comes back and forth in various ways about whether or not bicycle lanes should be built, whether or not bicycle paths should be built. And the question is a lot about infrastructure, and that's much less so about whether or not bicycles are illegal. But of course, if you build a new bridge and you don't put a bike ped path on it, and bicycles are not allowed on these main new highways or bridges that are built in the mid-20th century, then you're effectively banning bicycles.
You delve into certain characters in the book. And there are a couple who were really interesting. One is Arthur Hyde and the other was Violet Ward. Tell us a little bit about Arthur Hyde. Who was he and what did he represent in cycling?
Sure. He in the 1890s is a late teenager. He's about 19 and turns 20 when he keeps a cycling diary, which he keeps for several summers. And he records every single ride that he takes in and around New York State. And he rides for recreation, he rides for exercise, he rides for transportation to go to baseball games, but he also rides to commute to work. And he lives on the Upper East Side. And it's really fascinating because you can see the streets that he chooses to take, and it becomes clear that he has his own sort of mental map of the city in terms of which streets are most bicycle friendly and which ones are paved. But he gives this great glimpse into what it was like to be a cyclist in the 1890s. And he has some interesting experiences. He courts women and makes calls on them via bicycle and uses the bicycle as a way to meet women. And he eventually, in fact, marries somebody that he called on via bicycle. And he participates in parades. He, like many New Yorkers at the time, enjoyed riding late at night when the streets were much less crowded. And in fact, traffic studies revealed that the most popular hours to ride bicycles were 8 to 9 p.m., 9 to 10. But he has this one anecdote where he and his brother are on this long ride, and they live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. They ride out all the way to the eastern edges of Brooklyn. And he and his brother start drinking, and his brother essentially gets too drunk to ride his bicycle home. Leads to this sort of wild night where Arthur has to ride both bicycles back himself in order to not leave it out in Brooklyn. So there are amusing parts of it. There are scary parts of his diary. He runs over a few people. He himself gets in a few accidents. And he talks about the kinds of bicycles that he buys. And it's really just a great kind of window into a different world, like to be a serious cyclist.
So interesting that somebody would keep such an accurate accounting of his life with this bicycle. And when you look at it, if you just step back, you can almost imagine it happening today. Like the same kinds of things going on with the bicycle. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Evan Friss. His new book on bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City, has just been published. I've enjoyed it immensely. Evan's writing style is something that I like. Everybody knows I like good writing, and this is good writing. I enjoyed it. So who is Violet Ward? She is really kind of an interesting character.
Yes, she is also a cyclist in the 1890s, and she lives out in Staten Island, grows up the daughter in a very prominent upper-crust family. And she begins to engage in sports quite seriously, tennis, golf, and the bicycle more so than anything else, as a social activity, as a way to meet friends and to make friends. And she becomes part of this small circle of women who embrace the bicycle as an emancipatory device, as a kind of social leveler that will afford women new kinds of opportunity, social mobility, and also hopefully to women on some kind of par with men in all sorts of ways, not just socially, but politically as well. And so she's a kind of great example of one of a number of women, and there were tens of thousands of New York who saw in the bicycle this real opportunity to challenge certain social conventions about women not going out without a chaperone, about women's mobility in terms of being confined, and also challenging that women couldn't become cyclists because this was an exercise designed for men. It was too strenuous. It might lead to moral dangers or damage their physical constitutions in some way. So she was fighting back against some of these conservative mores.
Yeah, and there were a lot of women who felt that the bicycle was a way to freedom. And you know, the documentation in this book is just remarkable. I mean, there's almost as many pages of documentation as there are pages of dialogue. So it's really interesting. So I wanted to move forward in time a bit because the bicycle became more sophisticated, cycling expanded as a sport. And besides transportation and recreation, we actually have business going on by bicycle in the time of the messengers. Now, I was in business at the time the messenger era came about, and we had bicycle messengers here in Cleveland, but New York City was famous for the bicycle messengers, and they actually got into a little bit of a tiff with the mayor at the time. I think it was Ed Koch.
Yes. So Koch in 1987 decided that he was going to ban bicycle messengers from Manhattan, and he couldn't do this simply by banning them. So he found a workaround, which was to ban bicycles from three major avenues in Midtown Manhattan during the day, during the week. So people could ride their bicycle on these streets. It wasn't banning bicycles from the roads, which he couldn't because of this 1890s law I mentioned before, but he would effectively make it impossible for the messengers to do their job, or at least to do so economically. And people could commute to work as long as they got to their office by 9 o'clock. They could commute home. During the day, there would be no bicycles on these three large avenues. And the reason was he and many other people saw New York as a kind of chaotic place in the late 80s where crime was increasing. And in looking for a villain, an easy target were the bike messengers, who were blamed for traffic accidents, for running over pedestrians, and who were seen as a kind of symbol of the carelessness that unfolded on the streets and the danger of the streets themselves. It's also, I think, important to note that most messengers at the time were not white. They were young. Many were immigrants. So this was a particularly vulnerable group. And Koch expected not much of a reaction when he announced that he was banning bicycles. But quite to his surprise, the messengers began daily protests where they would march up Sixth Avenue, often walking, holding their bicycles, sometimes thrusting them toward the sky, snarling traffic and shouting and chanting about the ways in which the city should use its resources to improve the lot of cyclists and the way in which they should go after real villains and real criminals, not the innocent messengers who are merely delivering packages from law firms and modeling agencies and businesses to one another, who are actually doing a real service. And in the end, because of these protests, and they sue the city and they team up with bike advocates, they're able to not only beat the bike ban itself legally, but some of the sentiment in the city changes, where the conversation is in fact about Koch picking on these bike messengers who are providing an essential service to the city. And there were 5,000 of them strong who worked on a daily basis. And the concern was, or at least how they pitched it to the media, that if this ban would be in place, that many of these businesses would be hurt. And again, that he was sort of unfairly targeting this vulnerable group. So this was a great, and in some cases, rare victory for the cyclists that ushered in, I think, part of, was not only a bridge to critical mass, and of which became popular afterwards, especially in terms of its style, but also in terms of thinking of the bicycle as a really utilitarian tool. And that's one of the most, you know, remarkable transformations that happens in the 21st century, in terms of, at least in New York, prizing the bicycle as a legitimate alternative to the car.
It was remarkable. And then, of course, there were even movies made about messengers. There's Quicksilver Messenger. There's all this cool stuff that happened because of the messengers. I think now there's the Red Hook Criterium, which is sort of based on messenger-style bikes, track bikes with no brakes, that kind of stuff. Well, marching forward, then we've got Jeanette Sadiq Khan. I mentioned her before. She really made some huge changes, not always welcomed by a lot of people, but she really was a force to reckon with. And the landscape of cycling in New York has changed dramatically. How did her work impact the bicycle, and what's changed since she left? I know she's still with Bloomberg. She does her work all over the country, or all over the world, as a consultant. But she was really a special kind of a person in New York.
Certainly she was. She arrived in 2007, and I think it's important to remember that Bloomberg, when he was first elected mayor, really had no bicycles on his mind, and he begins to embrace the idea of sustainability, and bicycles become a part of that larger goal. And so when Sadiq Khan comes on board as commissioner of the Department of Transportation in 2007, she not only fulfills the initial goals that his administration had announced recently in terms of environmental stewardship, sustainability, but she's well beyond. And within a few months begins piloting what becomes now a staple, eventually a staple in New York, which are these, of course, protected bike lanes, where a row of parked cars are creating a barrier in order for cars to be, for bicycles to be separate from moving traffic on the street. And it becomes very successful, very fast. It makes cyclists feel safer. It is safer. And it encourages more people to bike. And she also, of course, is the brains behind City Bike, which is the nation's largest bike share, and which encourages many, many thousands of New Yorkers to commute by bicycle who wouldn't otherwise, in a way that is probably the most visible symbol of the bicycle renaissance in the 21st century, and certainly of her work during the Bloomberg administration. They were so successful that it became sort of obvious that her successor and Bloomberg's successor would at least continue building more bike lanes and protected bike lanes and would eventually expand City Bike, which has in fact happened. But de Blasio has been much cooler. The current mayor and now presidential candidate has been much cooler about bicycles, cooler in terms of, less worn the bicycles. He's gone on his own campaign to go after bike messengers who are using e-bikes in order to make deliveries. And there hasn't been any kind of transformative either infrastructure or policy like we saw with Jeanette Sadikon, who continues to be lauded as a kind of Jane Jacobs-like figure. And yes, she still works for Bloomberg and goes around the country and speeches and consults with cities around the world, in fact.
Well, I'm not sure you saw this, but Bicycling Magazine on June 6th published an article saying, in a deadly year for cyclists, New York City could make projected bike lanes a required option on major streets. So things are still happening in New York City in that regard. And it has been a deadly year here in Ohio also. We are hoping we're getting to the tipping point where law enforcement and roads and people recognize how vulnerable cyclists and pedestrians are. On a broader level, I'm wondering if you think that New York City's experiences, even going back 200 years, offer us a look into how the bicycle has been viewed throughout the country. So do you think that every time you look at New York and it does something, it's sort of like you're leading the charge? Is it happening elsewhere? Do you think that all of these gains you've made and all of the losses that New York has had is reflected everywhere else? And did people look to New York for those answers?
Yeah, certainly. I think that's happened in the past. You know, so even going back to the 19th century, one of the first big bike paths was built in New York from Prospect Park to Coney Island, called the Coney Island Cycle Path, and other cities around the country begin to model that. And even going up to, you know, the present day, the kind of protected bike lanes that are first seen in America in New York, and some of these designs had actually been imported from Europe, were now copied and borrowed in other cities, and bike shares propping up in many other cities, and not just super metropolises, but even some smaller sized cities. So I think New York has long been a leader in terms of urban design and other new kinds of bold infrastructure, and bicycles been the same way, especially during the Jeanette Sadikon era.
It's just such a fascinating conversation. The book, again, is On Bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City. The author is Evan Friss. We've been talking with him today. There is also an exhibit that you curated called Cycling in the City at the Museum of the City of New York. It runs through October, and it also seems to dovetail with this book. Yes, it comes right out of it.
Yes.
Yeah. So where can listeners get a copy of the book?
If you're in New York City, most of the bookshops in town carry it. But if you're in New York, you can order one straight from Columbia University Press, Amazon, or other online retailers.
And what's your next big project? This has been a good one. This is actually your second book on cycling, but do you have you have a third one coming out?
I'm not sure.
Aha. Keeping it under your hat. Well, Evan, thank you so much for talking with me today. Fascinating conversation. I'm glad we got to explore bicycles in New York City going all the way back to 1819. Much luck with the book.
Thanks.
And have a great day.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. You take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Dr. Evan Friss is a professor of history at James Madison University in Virginia. His book, On Bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City, was just published by Columbia University Press. And I believe it's a must-read if you love history and love the bicycle. If you are interested, you can find a copy in all the usual places. So that's our show for this week. My thanks to Dr. Jonathan Hirsch, to Tracy and Peter Flukey, and to Dr. Evan Friss for joining me. Next week, we'll catch up with Dan Worry as we delve into Mr. Froome's mishap, how the tour is shaping up, and what's going on in women's cycling right now. Remember, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, and you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. We'd really appreciate it if you would leave a review of the show on your favorite podcast app, too. That's how we get new listeners. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.